So give, love, share. So we can think about give a little, love a lot, share everything. You know, since it seems to be that... Good evening. So it seems to be that from a very early age we're encouraged to share your toys or whatever you have, you know, as children. At least I was brought up that way. I think generally we're brought up that way. And yet, even as adults, it can be so difficult to think about giving and sharing. I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe for everyone here it's absolutely natural. But, you know, because we're surrounded by all these things about... we don't get it so much in Australia, but in America, when they're talking about what you should have for yourself, and it says, because you deserve it, you know, you're number one. So these sorts of messages that are out there in the world seem to go against the idea of sharing, of generosity and caring for each other. An aspect of caring. So in terms of practice, so it's there in the world, you know, to practice generosity, and people are very good at practicing generosity at a time when there's like a crisis, there's a tsunami, there's a flood, etc., etc. But how do we maintain that on a daily basis? Doesn't mean giving away all your possessions. So we have to necessarily, we'd have to cultivate it with wisdom, use wisdom with it as well. So it's there generally in the world. It's certainly there in all religions. You know, when I was growing up as a Catholic girl in Newcastle, I used to love the stories hearing about... There was always this story about this woman who would come into the church and just anonymously put money in the box and, you know, give donations and so forth. Because at the church I went to on a Sunday morning, they'd read out the names of all the families who gave... certain amounts of money during the week, and it was all like my parents, we'd never had much money, and so my mother was always very embarrassed and anxious about this. So I like the idea of anonymous giving as well, because it also counteracts pride, you know, a sense of, oh, look how much I gave or whatever. I'm not saying any of their families did that, but, you know, when you hear that, I think it would be difficult. So the Buddha taught on, you know, this practice of dana quite extensively in terms of giving sort of material aid, giving protection from fear, giving the Dharma, obviously, giving love. So all these different ways we can practice giving. And, you know, it's really about cultivating an attitude in our mind of being willing to give. As I said, it's not about necessarily, oh, I have to give everything away with great resentment, because that's not really giving. That's a sort of few strings attached. Or if I give this to you, then maybe you'll give this to me. So we have to have some sort of purity of intention with our giving, or our intention to give. And it comes as the very first of, you know, when you look at the practices of, it starts with generosity or charity and then goes on to you know, ethics, and then patience, effort, concentration, wisdom. So we generally we start with generosity, and even before you get to developing concentration through meditation, because we have to somehow open ourselves to others and not just be looking after number one, and or even calling ourselves number one. So the generosity means we're willing to give, we're willing to share without hesitation. You know, my abbot, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, when he gets something already as it's coming into his hand, he's thinking who to give it to. this sense of, and he gets, because he's got many students around the world and so forth, he has a lot of gifts, and then he gives a lot of gifts. He gives them straight away. And many years ago, the monk who started our centre, 40 years ago or whatever, however long, long time ago. And anyway, so he had the job of, as soon as Lama Zopa received anything, of Lama Yeshe, who started our organisation, said, "Now, you've got to go and make sure he doesn't give it away." And he never got there on time. He'd already given it away, including his robes at one point, and they were going to the airport, and it's like, "We have to find some robes for you because you just gave it to that monk who walked out the door." So anyway, for most of us, it doesn't say give the clothes off your back, okay? The Buddha didn't say to do that. But so it doesn't mean we have to be rich, because it's also this intention. Even we can be extremely poor and feel like we have nothing to offer. But we can still have the willingness to give. And I'm reminded of, you know, from my tradition of the Tibetan people, and we say generally of the Tibetans, they're externally poor but internally rich. So they give a lot of that. They'll cook up a good feast, they'll sing, they'll dance, they'll do everything. It doesn't cost a lot of money, you know, but everyone's happy and everyone enjoys it. So like that, to have that sort of spirit of generosity. In fact, I remember years ago I was working in an aid organisation, and we had a woman come from the States. She was an expert on fundraising. And she said to us, "You know, the people who give are people like you." And I can say that to you. The people who give are people like you. The people who have the mindset of giving, of generosity, of sharing and so forth. And the people who have the mindset of accumulating and having are very good at that. And that's what they do. They accumulate, they have. They're not very good at giving. So it was really interesting to hear that there are the different mindsets. So even though I might have heard the messages from a young age, good evening, welcome. When I came to, sort of more actively practicing this, it's like, oh, maybe I'll give a dollar. Or maybe, you know, how much will you give? And I remember being in San Francisco with a woman who showed me all her credit cards and said, "Look, they're maxed out." And then we walked down the street and she gave $20 to, you know, a beggar on the street who just was, he was like, "Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you." I thought, he'll never forget her. He'll never forget that moment of generosity because it was so significant to him. Such a lot of money. Anyway, so, and the Tibetans have a saying, if I keep everything to myself, what's there left over to give? Because I've kept everything just for me. So, when we talk about... Good evening. So when we talk about giving in terms of possessions, it might be giving someone, you know, a roof over their head, or giving food, giving clothing. Even people give clothing to the secondhand shops, when hopefully not the stuff that's unwearable, because I think they have to put it in the rag bag. But, you know, that it's just like, well, you know, I don't need this anymore, which is something I did when I got ordained. I had a lot of clothes to give away. I didn't need them anymore. So we can give money, and there's lots of opportunities to do that. Medicine, I remember, although I'm not a doctor, you know, so you've got to be careful what medicine you give. I know that you can't give paracetamol out everywhere, you know, here, there and everywhere. You can to a friend, okay, but otherwise, yeah. But I went to our main monasteries in Nepal, Kopan Monastery, and I went there in November, December. We have a traditional, it's called the November course, because guess what? It's in November. Really, original name. So it's and then it gets colder into the beginning of December. And before I went, somebody said, "Now make sure you take medicine, because, you know, everyone gets a cold. So we all arrived there with our vitamins and our, you know, throat things and lozenges and everything. And because we were in retreat, so we couldn't, like, go out and get things. And so the whole month, you know, as the colds and flus passed through this group of 200 people, everyone just passed them around. In fact, the teacher, she had so much at her door, because everyone gave to the teacher, right? It was like she had a mountain, so she was, like, giving it away as well. I mean, very virtuous to give to the teacher, but, yeah, a whole lot of, you know, things to... and even we can't, you know, give physical things. We can, you know, a smile doesn't cost anything, does it? Or, you know, oh, may you enjoy the gorgeous weather. You know, people seem to talk about the weather all the time, so why not use it to make people's minds happy and not, you know, the weather. You know, it can be something nice, you know. And in the Buddhist teachings, obviously it's talked about we can give our bodies too, and I think that's an advanced technique. Of course, we hear the stories of the Buddha where the Buddha gave his body that, you know, like he saw in a previous life as a prince when he saw the tigress who was starving and contemplating. He could see from his clairvoyance she was contemplating, or maybe he could just see from just looking, eating her tiger cubs. And so he gave his own body. He sort of lay down, slit his throat because he realized she didn't eat him otherwise, unless there was some blood coming. Now, that's an advanced technique. I don't suggest you do that anytime soon, okay? Because he'd gone beyond an attachment to the body. But I do think about that, and I think, well, I can give blood. That's giving part of my body. You know, that's easy. So, you know, there's ways in which we can give off our body. We can give our energy. We can help people out, help them move. House, I don't know, you know, lots of ways that we can do that. But, you know, using the wisdom, there are situations where you don't want to give, where it's unwise to give. For example, what would be one that's unwise? If somebody, you knew that they were going to use the money for drugs, then you don't do that. I watched, I don't know if anyone's seen these programs, I hadn't seen them before, but it's Mental Health Week. Yeah, all month, but this week. So there's a lot of, on the ABC, there's a lot of programs, and I don't normally watch television, but I did watch this program about Campbelltown Hospital, about a mental health facility. And one of the clients there, one of the patients, who had snuck in and given, I think, had given a lighter to one guy and razor blades to someone who was suicidal. So that's unwise giving, you would say, wouldn't you? Clear. Okay, this was somebody with a mental health issue, so they obviously didn't have the capacity to think well about the situation. But given that we can, we use that wisely. Clearly, we don't give... fortunately, in Australia, we don't have the access to weapons like guns that they do in other countries. But we don't go around giving, you know, guns to people who are known terrorists or who are, you know, going to, or a bit mentally unstable or who are planning to kill someone. I mean, there's obvious situations. I can't imagine myself being in any of those situations, but we never know. So we've got to use our wisdom, you know, what not to give. Obviously, don't not giving people poison. You know. So when we're giving, yeah. So when we're giving food, give food they like. They like. Not I like, they like. Not, oh, I had this left over in my fridge, so here you go. You know. Of course, if you're sharing a house, I mean, I know in our place, so it's just like, you know, because when people bring food and you think, oh, we don't want it to go to waste, so, you know, while it's still fresh, of course, we offer that around. So, yeah, giving whatever we can. There was in Tibet there was a story of one yogi who didn't have much at all. So one of the most pure ways of giving is obviously giving to the Buddha. So we've got lotus lights here and giving the sound, we ring the bell. And so, and you know, we offer to the Buddha. We know the Buddha doesn't actually need those things, but this is helping us practice generosity. So again, Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, even giving a single flower to the Buddha, you know, just one flower, because It's not the actual how much we give, it's what's in our mind that keeps creating that sense of generosity, that sense of virtue in our mind. And is, in terms of future lives, it's the condition for having wealth. So it counteracts this idea, but if I give everything away, I won't have anything. It's really the opposite. If we give, abundance comes. Not maybe as quickly as we wish. Come on, abundance, I'm waiting for you. Not like that. But so making pure offerings to the Buddha, the most, okay, one flower, the most gorgeous one, or the one that makes our mind happy, because that's what it's about. And then we can imagine that the Buddha accepts it very happily, totally blissed out, really pleased, and then your mind's happy. It's such, all you've done is, physically, is one flower. So a few weeks ago, we were hosting school students from the Tibetan school, which is a Saturday school. You know, they have the community schools on Saturdays. So the Tibetan one. And they came to our place because they hadn't been to a traditional gompo, we call it, or temple. So they came there to learn meditation, to meet the abbot and learn something about their Dharma practice. So there were little five-year-olds and six-year-olds. And at the end we had a photo, and this one little girl came up to me with the tiniest little flower and gave that to me. It was so gorgeous. It just warmed my heart. Because first of all I thought, she's little enough to have noticed the flower. And this tiny little thing. I mean, she was tiny. The flower was tiny. It was just beautiful. So it can bring great joy, just the simplest little thing that we do. The consideration. You know, there's a school in Bronte where they have the kindness project, where the kids learn about being kind to each other, just little simple, well, we say random acts of kindness to each other. It cultivates this openness of the heart, this love within us, you know, Maitri, which is about caring. So, and then, you know, giving the Dharma. So this is what Unibuds is all about, giving the Dharma, sharing the Dharma, and experiencing a sense of sangha, a sense of community and joy in that. So like that. And of course you could say, yeah, but I'm not a teacher or so forth. It could be, for example, giving away free books, which I know you do, you have out there. So that's giving off the Dharma. Organizing the events. It can be, you know, just giving encouragement to others. Of course, as the Buddha said, you don't. And in any case, the Buddha wouldn't have taught unless somebody asked. He would have kept his lip closed and thought, "Oh, well, nobody seems interested. I'll go somewhere else where somebody is." So, but fortunately, the Buddha was asked, and we had the benefit of the teaching. So it's like that for any Dharma teacher. That no Dharma teacher would teach unless requested. So it's not like we go up to everyone we know and think, "Do you know what's good for you? I can tell you what's good for you. Come along." But as soon as people do ask and are interested, then we treat their questions seriously. So that's giving Dharma. You know, someone says, "Oh, what's all this karma about?" Or, you know, anything. Then, if they ask, with the prison project that we have, we give away, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of books, free books every year, and, you know, people to correspond with the prisoners, to answer their questions and so forth. So that's, you know, that's a way of, and then, you know, we give books to go into their libraries and so forth, and magazines. People might help with publishing books or translating or setting up a Dharma center in whatever way. So in any way that we benefit from the Dharma, without even using the word Dharma, without even talking about the Buddha's teachings, just by how we are in our being and, you know, putting our Dharma learnings into practice, is benefiting others, is offering them another way of being in the world. So like that. Okay. And then we give protection from fear. So there seems to be quite a bit of fear in the world. often this type of generosity is about helping people when they're in a bad state. If they're so giving some sort of reassurance. So I spoke to a woman earlier today, for example, just an example that's in my mind, and her son has suddenly, he hasn't been diagnosed with something, but he's in hospital having all these tests and they don't know what's wrong with him. She's very fearful. So being able to offer some reassuring words. Again, I'm not the health professional, who knows what the outcome will be, but at least to be able to know, oh, we'll offer prayers for you. So that's a generosity from our side to say, we'll offer prayers to you for your son, you know, and, you know, give some help, give some advice. She asked for some practices she could do, so giving that. But just to know you're being supported at those times when you really, help, you know, I really need some help. So it helps, you know, soothe the mind a little. It doesn't make the problems go away, but it's good, you know, to know there's someone there who cares and supports you. You might, for example, save animals. Again, when I was at Copan, anyway, I do it a lot, but saving ants from drowning. But when I was at Copan, because I had this is why we have a lid. Do you know? This is why we have a lid. Is to protect it from any beings inadvertently falling in. I'm not sure if any beings are going to inadvertently fall in here, but that's what covering a water supply or a liquid, you know, putting a top on it. Anyway, so I had an apple juice which did have a top on it, but somehow the ants got in. I didn't have a refrigerator or anything like that, so the ants got in and I was devastated. So I lay them all out. I got all the toilet paper I could find. Went to the bathroom, lay them all out. And guess what? They come back to life. So I didn't, you know, I thought, I've drowned hundreds of ants. What karma is this? Anyway, they started and I started escorting them outside and doing mantras and prayers for them. And I thought anyone who wasn't, a Buddhist would, looking at this would think, what's she doing? But I thought, in an operating theatre, you know, doctors and nurses, they'll do everything to save one life, won't they? So, you know, why not do everything we can to save a lot of lives? Anyway, that was my simplistic thinking at the time. But giving that sort of protection, animals in particular live a very fearful lives. They're always worried about being killed. Probably by humans like me, but by other animals. And so, you know, we have practices of animal liberation, for example, freeing animals from being killed. So in Singapore, I know one of the monks there who, he was previously a commandant or comedy, someone very high up in the army. And for a few years now, he made a commitment. I can't remember what the overall commitment is, but in his mind, to release 10 million fish. And he's on his way to do that. So every year he releases millions of fish into the harbour. So what a wonderful thing, saving fish. Putting them back in the water. So there's lots of ways that we can do that. Another way is to give a sense of confidence to others, or equanimity, that others have nothing to fear from us. So we're not creating fear in others just by being more relaxed, confident, trustworthy in ourselves is a way of giving protection from fear. So that it's not sort of, not getting angry, hostile, or so forth, or ignoring people, or putting them down, this sort of thing. So the practice of generosity actually in itself cultivates this confidence where it's like we don't have anything to fear either. So it's a win-win. You know, other people don't fear us and we don't have something to fear as well. So by, you know, sort of practicing saving lives where we can, obviously if you're planning to be a vet, a doctor, a nurse, anything in the health professionals, then that's you're saving lives all the time, so that's brilliant. So we help any way we can, and that, you know, is, I guess, our contribution as well to counteract war, or if we can, by, you know, saving lives wherever possible. Okay. And then giving active love. So having an attitude of love towards others. So as I'm always reminded, is the example of Richard Gere. And this is in the example that love is wanting others to be happy. Okay, so that's in the Buddhist sort of term, that's what we're talking about. It's not about going around hugging everybody, I love you, I love you, I love you, because I think if you did that in the street, generally in the city, you know, some people are not going to like it. And, you know, I know there was a hugging movement at one point. Everyone agreed, though. They all went on to the beach and hugged each other. But, you know, that's another thing. So, you know, wisdom. But it's having that attitude. And Richard Gere's example. So you know who Richard Gere is? So he's an actor. I had to ask because I'm of a certain age that, of course, I know who Richard Gere is, but you're not of that certain age. So he's a, having said that, quite a well-known American actor, successful American actor, who's also a great Dharma practitioner. And he, in one of the little, he did some Dharma clips for us. Pretty Woman. Yeah. It's probably, have you ever seen that? It's quite a few years ago now. Him and Julia Roberts. And he was quite famous for that one, right? Anyway, it's been in a lot of movies. And so he did some little Dharma interviews for some courses our organisation was putting together. And he said, you know, everyone I meet, I think, may you be well, may you be happy. He said, I think it. I don't go up to them and say, may you be well, may you be happy. So just having that, that's a generous thought. May you be well. It's giving the act of love. May you be well, may you be happy. The other person doesn't need to know you're thinking that. They don't need to know. But if you next time you go shopping, next time you're in a bank queue, think of the person in front, may you be well, may you be happy. It's going to transform your experience of being in that bank queue or any other queue that you're in anywhere. Completely transforms it really easily. Again, they don't know anything's going on, but it's cultivating this spirit of generosity within ourselves, this spirit of love towards others. So, and then as a result, we don't get harmed by negativity. So it's a win-win as far as I can see. Anyway, so practicing love, of course, you know, anything that we practice just for ourselves is not a true act of giving. So, I was thinking about, you know, going back to the material things. If we give something to someone because we want to get something in return, that's not an act of generosity. I'll give you this because secretly in my mind, I think then I'll get that, or, you know, whatever it is that we want. And I think that happens in relationships a lot. We put expectations on each other, you know, and or at least that's what I did. You know, it's sort of like you have expectations that you're going to get something in return, and if we can give freely without that expectation, then our mind's not going to be disappointed. That's the thing. And because what are we going to do then? We're going to turn something that should be a positive experience into something negative, you know, and then get bitter and twisted. And you're too young to be bitter and twisted, by the way. I hope. I certainly hope so. So, you know, we have to give with a proper motivation, which is to benefit the person who's receiving it, you know. And we can think about their immediate benefit. So, for example, our teachers, in my organisation, you know, our lamas, will, you know, as a way of enthusing people into the Dharma, will give things. you know, as I said, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, as soon as he got something, he'd give to people. So sometimes you can go and see him and you've taken a gift and you walk out with more than you came in with. It's just like, hold on a minute, I just got all of this. And then, you know, and or he'll cook a meal, you know, this sort of thing. So giving physically, materially, as a sort of a way to encourage people, enthuse people, and open their minds and open their hearts, and then, you know, the Dharma teachings come. So we have to do our best if, you know, to keep our heart open and think, this is, I'm practicing this generosity for a few reasons. I'm practicing it to bring joy or bring what somebody else needs, but also to free up my mind. So there was, I remember one Lama saying, he said, this was some years ago, because I think he'd say something, he'd probably say MP3s or something now, but he said, I've got such a CD collection because my students have, you know, renounced things and given them away to me. Now, as a monk, as a nun, we don't need CD collections, because guess what? We've taken a vow against all that music stuff and everything, so what are we doing with a CD collection? So he didn't need that. So if we want to give away our CD collections, maybe don't give it to the temple. They don't need it. So give, you know, something that's going to be useful. Something that's going to be useful. And one of the lamas also said, I don't need any more incense. I've got so much incense. Like, if you want to give me something useful. Of course, it's wonderful for the, you know, for our temples, for our centres and whatever, to get the incense. Like, I just got given a whole bunch of incense, and I think, oh, that goes for the prisoners, and, you know, you just pass it on. So it's like that. So as monks and nuns, and I think generally it's a good practice to, when people give, to accept things they give. Not to say, oh no, I don't, you know, I've already got one of those, or whatever. Because you're helping that person practice generosity. In fact, one of my Dharma friends, our centre used to be in Newtown, and in Newtown, more so than in Ashfield, a lot of people on the street begging, asking for money, and so forth. And so she would give to this woman pretty much all the time, and who was begging on the street, and every time the Dharma practitioner gave the money, she would say thank you, and the woman would go, why are you thanking me? I'm the one who's getting the gift. And in her mind she's thinking, because this has given me the opportunity to practice Dharma, this has given me opportunity to, you know, sort of be less miserly and, you know, less greedy, and to give something sort of like that. So, you know, we have to accept things. And, you know, even if it's, for example, for myself, you know, when you have a precept of not eating in the evening and someone says, come to dinner, and I'll say, well, I'll come and join you. I can't, you know, I won't be actually eating dinner, but I can come and join you and drink tea and, you know, whatever. If there's no good reason to refuse, and, you know, there can be always legitimate reasons not to be able to do something, but where we can, because it's opening our heart connection with each other to be able to do that. So there's the Buddha really encouraged that. And that when we give, that we don't make such a fuss. We don't make a fuss of it. So that, and particularly giving to, if you give to your teachers, it's just sort of, I know, because, you know, when you have, like, often it's given in an envelope because the monks and nuns with a vow of not touching money in different traditions. And then it's just sort of left. It's not like make a big thing out of this, oh, I'm giving you this big offering or whatever. So, because again, what's that? That's pride from our side and expecting some response. As monks and nuns, we also have the thing of not putting too much emphasis on what we receive, not overthanking people, you know, from our side of not having that sort of attachment. So in that way, it's better to give just quietly and without expectations and so forth. And even though we can have our intention, like I read one story of an organisation, they saw what the monks were eating in the monastery and thought, oh, we've got to get some better food for them in the monastery. So they gave them all this money, and they used the money to build something else. And then they thought, oh, actually, if we want them to eat better, we've got to bring the food. Duh, yeah, it would be good. So even the monastery, you know, it's not necessarily going to be skillful means of accepting that. But once we've given, it's like it's not really up to us. Of course, if we really do know somebody's going to use that for harmful means towards themselves or others, if we know that, we'll avoid that completely. But if they use it for something else, you know, we can't really prevent that. But we have to, in our own minds, have you know, the proper motivation for what we give. So there's a you know, there's ways that we can give that are improper, which might be we feel obligated to give something because, oh, I have to give because it's their birthday and we always, or Christmas or whatever, and we always give. I mean, there's always those sorts of pressures, isn't there? And then you think, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've got so many nieces and nephews, and particularly when they were much younger, it's like, what do you give a 2-year-old? What do you give a 3-year-old? I wouldn't have a clue. So maybe you feel in the same boat. we've got to, you know, have some sense of not just giving from obligation or so forth, but putting some sort of thoughtful consideration into that, because we're using it to counteract our own, you know, just wanting things for ourselves. And in the same time, we're building up, you know, positive energy, a lot of merit, a lot of virtue for ourselves. And I've mentioned not out of pride. And that we give personally from our side. So, what's his name? Lama Ratisha, he lived in India in the 11th century, and he was a great scholar, and he went to Indonesia, he went to Tibet and revived. Buddhism had become a bit confused in Tibet by that stage, and all the teachings weren't coherent, so he drew it all together again. So he was a great practitioner. But he would have an attendant who always, when he was making the offerings to the Buddha, the attendant would want to do it for him. And he'd say, no, no, I have to make my offerings myself because I've got to get the merit, you know, and the virtue from doing that. But it can also be, so, you know, it can also be that we make the offerings to the Buddha, especially to the Buddha, because that's the most pure offerings we're going to offer from our minds. Is we have to, or to our teacher, we have to do that with, you know, a joyful mind. Like, for example, at our centre, there is somebody who does that every morning and, you know, does all the offerings. And we never want it to be that someone feels like, oh, that's my job, I have to do it, because that's not... particularly in relation to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, you don't want it to be like, this is an obligation, this is what I have to do. So giving that sense of joy in the offering, and, you know, to always give with a happy mind. So I was going to talk about this one yogi in Tibet who I'm sure other people have done that. So making the offerings on the altar. So he was very poor and he only ever had one bowl. So he'd make the offering to the Buddha in the morning, and then when he went to have his breakfast, he'd say, "Oh, excuse me, Buddha, I'm sure you don't mind if I just borrow the bowl." And he'd take the bowl. Because we always say we keep our special bowls for the altar, but he only had one bowl. So, "Oh, excuse me, I hope you don't mind." And then he'd have his breakfast, and then he'd make an offering again. So, you know, like that. So that's okay, you know. It doesn't have to be that you've, you know, got to be rich to do it, or, you know, have everything special. It's really what's in our heart, what's in our mind. So if we practice joyful giving, we experience a sense of confidence. So it's a win-win, you know. We grow in our self-respect and well-being. And we can also, we're testing our limits. So I remember one of the senior nuns who was at our centre previously, and she'd be out with students, and somebody, because we were in Newtown, and somebody would be asking for money, and they'd give like $5, and she'd say, "That's not enough, you've got to give more." And they'd say, "Oh, I gave them $20 like this." It was hard. So, because it's testing your boundaries of, you know, what can I, how generous can I really be, you know, because we have this sense of, I'm going to be without. It's irrational, really. Because if you think about it, am I living without? I mean, we can live on, as the prisoners say to me, "You don't need much, do you?" And the prisoners, believe me, do not have a lot. You know, they've got a uniform. They've got, you know, a bed, very rudimentary. They've got a toilet. Sometimes they've got to share even that. You know, they get their 3 meals a day. If they're lucky, they can get the books, because then they can study. You know, they might have some stationery. And that's about it. They don't have a lot. You know, they have access to a computer, but they don't have access to internet, etc., etc. They don't have their own. So, you know, I'm not suggesting we all go in prison and live like a prisoner, but we can let go of, not so much let go of the things, but let go of, you know, strongly holding on to, "This is the source of my happiness," whatever it is, you know. So like that. So if we, you know, practicing generosity, you know, stops the fists from grasping and actually makes open hands. So it creates space. It creates space in our minds. It, you know, it lets us be much more open. And then on the basis of that, then our meditation practice can flourish. So we're practicing the external generosity towards someone else, but the internal transformation that comes from that, that we can develop in our meditation. This is why in those practices, generosity comes before meditation. Often we just sort of start with a meditation. So think what it's like when the mind is grasping and desiring, and it's quite brittle, fragile, narrow, you know, sort of closed in. And that's when you feel uneasy, edgy, this sort of thing. And we don't like ourselves very much. And so, by contrast, when our mind's spacious and open, it doesn't feel so constricted, confined, and we're more open. We're more open to notice others, for a start, because we're not sort of all enclosed in our body and mind. And, you know, we're not sort of having a sense of desperation. So the Buddha said that having a true spiritual path is not possible without a generosity of spirit of our heart. It's that very first quality of the awakened mind of a Buddha that we cultivate, and the joy that comes from that practice. So, any questions so far? Let's see how we go.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
You mentioned that little girl that gave you the flower.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really nice thing to do, but what do you do with the flower afterwards?
What did I do with the flower afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, Because it's such a nice thing to do, there's a sure there's a something that makes you want to keep that for a while.
Yeah, I did keep it for a while, actually. I kept it for a while because, first of all, we were having photos and that took a while. And then, you know, I think, I can't recall, but, you know, went in and put it on the altar. Wow. So, yeah, it's like, you know, the gift that keeps giving, you know, you give it on.
Sometimes my Thai friends in Thailand give me a little good luck charms.
Yeah.
I never know what to do with them, but you keep collecting them, can you?
Yeah, well, you could find other people to give them to.
Oh, yeah.
They can go around. We had a nice little ritual going on for a while. It was a Bali Buddha. It was a wooden Buddha that came from Bali. It was called the Bali Buddha. And it got every year, this ritual started every year on, I think it was the 6th of March for some reason. It got passed around. You know, one person would have it for a year, and then they'd give it to the next one, but they'd give the whole lineage of who they got it from all the way back to who first had it. And it was a beautiful thing to pass it around like this, to just keep feeling like, oh, I'm receiving this gift that it's temporary, but it's coming with all these other blessings with it as well from everyone who's had it previously. And I think, for my mind, this is similar to, you know, what's practiced a lot in Aboriginal culture, of the sense of nobody owning anything and sharing everything. And I think we, you know, that's a really wonderful thing. In our centre, we're a few times a week before classes, you know, somebody different comes in and cooks a meal, and we all share that together. And that's a really lovely thing, because then people share the recipe, they share everything about the cooking, just like you're going to do on your cooking day, you know. And it's a fun. It's fun, and it's sharing with each other. It's really a very powerful thing. And so I saw, for me who doesn't watch much television, I saw, what was his name? Anthony Mundine, you know, during the week being painted by Anne Doe, that program they have on television. They have a program on ABC. And it was really lovely, because you heard Anthony Mundine talking about this, that, you know, when, because in the Aboriginal culture, if you're keeping this tradition alive, whatever you've got, you share with everyone. And so he's got quite a lot of money. And so his mother will say, okay, there's 100 other people to feed. So he feeds them. You know, it's no big deal, because it's in your culture to do that. And, you know, for me, it's been interesting growing up in a culture that was sort of a little bit like that, but not 100%. Like a certain amount of sharing, but there's also the what's mine's mine and what's yours is yours sort of thing, you know, particularly amongst my brothers and sister and me, you know, they're ours, you know, labelled. So this, to break that down and have a sense of, well, actually, we can have this spirit of reciprocity, of helping each other, of caring and making sure nobody goes without. It's really, you know, we can transform the world that way. We can transform our own minds that way and really make a difference in people's lives. Like on the way here, I heard on the radio, and it was, I can't remember. Anyway, so one of those talkback things on the ABC, and anyway, the presenter was talking about how his father, oh no, it wasn't his father, it was someone who'd been like a mentor to him. He called him his uncle. He wasn't like a blood relative. And that he used to be always so generous in offering to drive him everywhere when he was a kid. And the presenter was saying, well, you know, I felt like I was taking him out of his way. And and this guy would just say, oh, it's just a turn of the wheel. I'm just turning the wheels. I'm just turning the wheels. And so now, as a father, he gives lifts to his son's friends. And when they say, oh, I don't want to be taking you out of the way, he goes, oh, I'm just turning the wheels. So he's passing on the lineage, which is because it had such an impact on him. And this is where we can carry that on. And then, of course, if we understand the Buddha's teachings, not just carrying it on this life, but the merit we're creating and virtue we're creating carries on lifetime to lifetime for us, regardless of the impact that has had on someone else. Okay. So, So was there any other questions coming up? Nope. Okay. So just another few bad examples from my life, or learning, what do you call them? Learning experiences. So when I first went to India, particularly in one place that I was, there was a very strong culture of begging. And I wasn't ordained at this point, so it was before I was ordained, this strong culture of begging. And so these kids would be hanging off you all the time. And at one point we thought, well, you know, again, we've got to use skillful means, you know, what is your capacity to actually physically give? And so I would think in the morning, okay, whatever change I've got here, I'll give that, and when it's gone, you know, I mean, it's rupees. And when it's gone, it's gone. And then one time we were out driving, and these kids were visiting a holy relic, and the kids showed us around. And then as we were leaving, you know, they asked for something. And I thought, well, I had however many rupees note in my bag. So I gave them that. And then as we drove off, I saw them fighting amongst themselves, ripping it apart. So now it was worthless. Now it was nothing. You know, it was just a bit of paper that had some monetary value when it was intact. And then I thought, oh, I had a mandarin there. Maybe if they'd pulled that apart, they could have actually eaten it. That would have been more skillful. So, you know, you've got to... you've got to sort of do it with skillful means. So, and also in the act of generosity of not ways that we can degenerate that or contaminate our, you know, maybe good intention in the first place, is of boasting about it, gloating about it. You know, oh, I gave, you know, so much to so-and-so or whatever. Or remind people about, I have done so much for you. I have given you, I mean, ever heard those words? Ever said those words? I gave you, I have done for you, whatever. And I think, anyone a parent here? Anyway, maybe you've heard parents say that, or maybe as children of parents, you know, sons and daughters said that or heard that. And it just brings up a whole big guilt factor, and that's, you know, completely destroys the virtue of having, you know, done the giving in the first place. So we have to think they're doing us a favour by accepting what we give. And, you know, not, you know, when we, again, on another tack, when we give someone something, not think, oh, you know, not to think, oh, well, I've benefited you so much and I've given you so much and I've done you a favour. In fact, they're doing us a favour. So we have to think about it in that way, like my friend on the street who was giving to the beggar, and the beggar saying, why are you thanking me? It's because she's saying, well, you are doing me a favour. You are helping me to practice to let go and, you know, have a spirit of generosity and kindness and what really matters. And that's what will help us, you know, attain liberation, attain enlightenment, you know, be free ourselves of, you know, all the afflictions or the negative states of mind. So like that. Okay. So any other questions? No? Okay. So when we are thinking of practicing generosity, I mean, even though in that situation in India when I first went, I thought I will only give this much and no more, like all the change. It wasn't an amount, but it's better to have the intention of, well, whatever I had, and if I did have it, I would give, and not limit ourselves because we're telling ourselves, oh, I don't have the capacity. You know, I can't possibly have greater capacity than this. And so we have to sort of free up that aspect of our mind, you know, and delight in the giving that we do. Again, thinking about whether it's physical possessions, whether it's material things, whether it's shelter for someone. So, for example, when our centre used to be in Newtown, every Friday afternoon, it seemed, or regularly on a Friday afternoon, I can't literally say it was every Friday afternoon, we'd have people come and knock on the door and say, oh, I've heard I can stay here for the night. And we didn't have room. We didn't have room. We weren't that quite, and still aren't, that type of place where people could just rock up and stay for the night. But instead of saying, well, you heard wrong, bang, goodbye. So we'd have a chat to them and say, well, you know, have you, you know, let them know their choices, who they could, you know, where they could possibly get a bed for the night, or, you know, are you on Social Security? What have you done with your Social Security money, etc.? And I remember one afternoon, there was a woman who had regularly come and, you know, every time she came, the office manager would give her $20 or something and she'd go off. And this time, the office manager said, well, I'm willing to give you the $20, but you have to start taking responsibility for your life. You have to start looking at, you know, you've got a budget with what you have got, you know, you're getting this much Social Security or whatever, and you can't just keep having this mind of dependency. And she talked to her for quite a while like this. And then she went to hand her the $20, and this woman said, oh, no, thanks, I don't need it, you're right. So that was really helpful. She gave her advice that she was willing to listen to, and she found that, I mean, I hope that then she was able to do something herself to turn that around. Because the power of what we can do in terms of listening to people, I mean, giving time to listen to people, sometimes people don't want to hear advice. They just want an ear, isn't it? We know for ourselves, you know, someone jumps in and starts to give advice and it's just like, just listen to me, just, you know, because we just want to go, blah, this is my situation and it's really awful. Okay, and that's what friends are for, isn't it? You know, patiently, kindly listen, generous ears. And if they want advice, then, you know, that's another thing. But often the advice is, it may not be welcome when we're in a state of, either anxiety or fear or upset or whatever it is at the time. And then when we can go, we can talk it through, then we might be open to advice. But even then, as you probably know your friends and you know yourself, we have to be a bit skillful, tactful in how we go about giving that advice. Not like, well, I've been telling you now for years that this would happen and so forth. And so, of course, someone who I think is incredibly skillful like that, the Dalai Lama, this woman, you know, at public talks where people are able to ask questions. This was up in Brisbane. And this woman was trying to ask her question, but she was so emotional that it was coming with a lot of tears and so forth. So she was like quite some rows back, and His Holiness just called her up to the stage and threw his arms around her and gave her a big hug, and then she calmed down and then she could ask her question. So that was very, you know. So the hugs for friends, okay, just not out there on the street to everybody. And if it's a Dalai Lama or someone like that, I'm sure you won't resist. Yes, he's a monk and he was hugging a woman. Put it in the context. He was helping her to calm down, because before he hugged her, he said to Richard Feidler, who was doing the interview, because he mentioned later that His Holiness had said, oh, too much emotion. So he'd helped her calm down. for not judgment, just noticing, you know, she's too overwrought, sort of like that. And then giving to, I mean, this is not an advertisement, as long as I mean, this is not an advertisement, but giving to ordained sangha, to monks and nuns, is an incredible source of virtue, because, you know, skillful or not, we're there as representatives of the Buddha's teachings. So they say even more than giving to the Buddha, more merit, because it's the ones who are, you know, at least doing our best to keep the Buddha's teachings alive and keep that, you know, in the world. Of course, everybody, but because of the numbers of vows that monks and nuns take, then your giving increases the amount of merit that you collect from doing that. And then even you think, well, somebody else gave blah blah blah, if we rejoice in what others did, their generosity, then we get, the Buddha said, if you rejoice in the merit and the virtues of others, if they're at the same level as you, you get the same amount of merit. If you're further progressed along the path, then you get double their merit. So double merit points, not double demerit, double merit, you know, very important distinction. And then if they're further advanced on the path, you get half their merit. So half the merit of a Buddha, half the merit of a great teacher or whatever. So the different ways, you know, simply by freeing up our mind, that we can practice this spirit of generosity, of, you know, being kind, making offerings. And then that flows into our meditation. Then it brings the joy internally in our meditation practice. So we can practice that, you say, kindness or generosity to ourselves by really cultivating these positive aspects of our mind. So, but it's doing it without grasping on, without being selfish about it, because our intention is, well, the more I can transform my own mind, the more I can really skillfully benefit others, because if I can attain the mind of a Buddha, I know what's perfect for each and every being. I know how to speak to them, I know how to act, and everything I do will be perfect. So we do our internal work along as with the external gestures of giving. Okay. So there must be a question, a comment, an observation, a story.
Ask one about the animals.
Yes, the animals.
You mentioned earlier about the ants.
Yes.
And very carefully put them on.
Yes.
I've noticed that at the Venerable Chaplain's place, at Venerable Lemire, when we're doing our walking meditation,
yep,
we're sort of walking around and there might be a string of ants, and everybody treads over them.
Yeah.
Compassion. As soon as you get to the dinner table, all that goes out the window. And it's actually quite shocking, that place, how much meat they eat at that place. And I'm just wondering how you...
Where's this place here?
Budurangsi. You know, Chalkwins, am I?
Oh, so they eat meat?
Yeah, a lot of meat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually shocking how much they eat.
Yeah. We've had that at our place too. I mean, not generally all the time, because our abbot is a very passionate vegetarian. And, you know, a lot of us have been vegetarian for most of our lives. So it's sort of like, but, you know, occasionally, I mean, you've got to think about, say, in the situation I'm thinking of, Tibetan lamas who grew up in Tibet. There's a lot of, not a lot of fresh vegetables in Tibet. There's a lot of fresh meat. So we have to put in context that the Buddha gave, that didn't give a teaching, say, do not eat meat. Okay? We can logically make all sorts of deductions. The Buddha didn't say, do not eat meat. But the Buddha said, don't directly ask, I can't say, will you go and kill that sheep, cow, whatever, for me and cook it up so I can eat, because I'm causing you the karma of killing. I've also asked you to do that, so it's double whammy. So So that's literally about the Buddha's teachings. And then if people offer in dana, they offer meat, the vows of monks and nuns is that they have to eat it.
I did ask a monk in Thailand once what happened if I offered him human flesh, and he said he would refuse it.
He'd refuse human flesh. He probably knew you wouldn't be offering it any time soon.
Probably, but I'll try to sort of go to the extreme.
Yeah, yeah, I know, I understand. But it's good. It's good to go through the logical arguments to see, I was going to say it was difficult in our situation because we had a traditional Tibetan Lama who came in. Beforehand, we get their diet, you know, what they eat, what they don't eat, and so forth, so that what we offer, they're not having to, you know, be in a difficult situation of refusing. We make sure we cook what they want, you know, make sure it's what they want, make them happy. Anyway, so there was there was meat on the list, and so the person who did the shopping got a discrete amount of meat, like if you were cooking up vegetables and rice and a bit of meat mixed in with it, and she thought that would do for the whole week. Well, that was one meal, and she said, I've got to go out and buy meat big time. He eats meat. And they come from that, you know, I guess tradition or whatever, got used to it, whatever it is. So that was the situation for that particular lama. But for example, our abbot, even though Tibetan, never been to Tibet, grew up in the south of India, and grew up vegetarian, and he's very happy vegetarian. I don't know if he entirely grew up vegetarian in the monastery, but I know a lot of the monasteries now are encouraging vegetarianism.
So who gets the bad karma for killing the sheep?
The one who killed. So the one who killed gets the karma of killing.
So that's how they justify it, saying it's not my
fault. Well, it's not justifying, it's literally a cause and effect. That you kill, you get the karma of killing. So the people working in abattoirs are getting the karma of killing all the time. And the people who started the abattoirs, you could say, are getting that because they set up these slaughterhouses. They're for slaughter. They're for killing.
It's like playing a hitman to go and kill someone.
Yes. It's same, isn't it? It's an animal or it's a person. Same. So that's the direct, but using the argument that you used, you know, if you start applying logic, the logic that I apply is, okay, here I am living in Sydney. There's every food in the world available to me. There are other ways I can get protein. I have a certain choice over the food I eat. And I'm not perniciously anemic or anything else that would require me to have hunks of red meat or whatever. And I will follow that. And to this day, touch wood, not that I'm superstitious, I haven't been offered meat. And well, you see, I have to accept it. But the way I interpret accept is I have to accept it, but I don't necessarily have to eat it. See, it says accept. We have vows to accept what is given. I mean, I had a fellow... colleague, nun of mine, the day she was ordained, she was offered a meal with chicken. And so she's ordained, and she goes, no. And her lama said, you sit there, you eat that. And all I think is, I'm glad it wasn't me. But, you know, it was a lesson for her. What the lesson was, I wouldn't know. The lesson of acceptance, you know. And this is the thing, someone, like, I remember in Bundanoon when the monks were going on alms round, and this guy came up and said, what can I put in there? Do you have to eat whatever's in there? And he said, and the monk said, yes. And he said, well, what can I put in here? Whatever you put in there, we eat. And he went into the shop, bought a meat pie and put it in. There's lunch. So it's like that. So this is where... with the acceptance of, you know, receiving what's offered on the other side, the flip side of the generosity of receiving what's offered, you have to receive it.
I noticed that Buddha and Sai, they offer soap.
Yes. Soap and
money sometimes.
Soap, well, money's, you know, bills have to be paid. Soap, toothpaste, all this sort of thing, you know. Human bodies, just like everybody else.
But you don't have to eat it, do you?
No. I mean, and that's the thing, you know, they're practical things to give. So you think of giving to Sangha, practical things that they can use and that they need to use. Yeah, yeah. Nobody's ever offended by that, so, you know. And where that is, that sort of thing of, why did you give me soap? Are you trying to tell me something? No, you just happily accept. So like that, having an open mind, open spirit. And I had an interesting situation, like, where one of our students has been bringing in, you know, these packets of biscuits, and she seems to bring more and more each time. And I said to her the other day, no, you don't need to bring quite so many. And she looked a bit, and I thought, that was very stupid of me. I just zipped the lip and she can bring as many as she wants. I just didn't want her to feel obligated that every time she turned up she had to bring more and more biscuits. But yeah, so things like that happen. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I guess in response to that question by Simon, I've actually heard Chao Kun answer that question before.
Yes.
And he mentioned that so he wouldn't eat, like, if he knows the animal was killed specifically for his lunch or dinner,
yes,
he wouldn't eat it. And similarly, like, he would eat anything else that was offered to him. He doesn't specifically ask for meat in that sense.
Yes.
So I guess he's not asking for something to be killed for his dinner.
No.
It just happens that someone offered it to him and he's not accepted. I guess in that sense, like, we can't really say that it's his fault or, like, he's specifically, like,
no,
trying to do it. Yeah.
Because it, you know, that's the vows that we take.
Sorry?
I could answer back if you want. I mean, Chao Kun is in charge of that place.
Yes.
He can say, Kon Tai, don't bring food in, meat in, and that would solve the problem. Because it's not only the monks that eat that stuff, it's the...
It's others as well.
People that come in as well.
Yeah.
And they've got no excuse, you know, by saying, oh, it's been offered to us. They go down to butchers and they buy this stuff.
Yeah.
I guess it comes out of tradition. And as I think... The Buddha never specifically said we're not allowed to
eat,
just that we're not allowed to kill.
Yes.
And doesn't have the cow, though, does it?
I guess.
No, and that's and that's where individually we can make that choice.
Yep.
Because individually I can say for myself, I feel more comfortable with the fact that I'm not contributing to the demand for meat to be killed. But then I have to look at, okay, if I'm eating vegetables, how many insects are dying? It's more than one animal. So many beings are dying to produce my vegetables. It's true, isn't it? And so then you say, okay, well, maybe organic as much as possible. So you do what you can. That's within your remit. And then you say, okay, well, I'm doing what I can. And even eating meat, you know, we have mantras to bless the being that provided that meat. And as Lama Zopa said to us, that means you have a karmic connection with that being. You know, so that's produced that meat for you. That is that meat. That is that meat. Or was that meat? I mean, their consciousness has gone somewhere else by the time. Let's hope. Let's hope, actually, by the time they're slaughtered. Because, actually, if you think about animals, because we have all these practices, you know, what we're going to do at the time of death, but if we think about that in the terms of animals, they don't very often get that opportunity to have their minds be peaceful. And unless they're some wonderful Dharma practitioner's pet, you know, they're most beings, most animals die in fear. The ones going to the slaughterhouses, just the smell before they get there, when they're on those trucks and everything. It's awful. That's why whenever I go past those trucks, we sort of yell prayers and mantras at them and, you know, whatever. So I don't know if it helps, but it helps my mind to just to think of the potential suffering, you know, and wanting them not to have that. So, yeah. Okay. What else? Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, please.
It's more just a comment. I don't know if there's a question in there, but I think it was great how you mentioned, like, giving time to people,
yes,
being generous. But I also think about, like, we say, like, give me time, as in like stay away from.
Oh, give time out. Yes.
Yeah, but that I think is also practicing generosity,
yeah.
Because you're still giving that person like what they want, and so it's like not necessarily like an active.
Well, it is active though, because you've made a decision. Okay, I'm giving you time away, time out,
yeah.
Space.
Yeah.
You know, whatever we want to call that. That's yeah. Still an act of giving.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be your physical presence to be an act of giving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Nice.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful. And, you know, why should we have an expectation that we're going to live in each other's pockets 24/7 or whatever? You know, it's just unrealistic, unbearable, I would think. Yeah.
On a similar topic, you mentioned about giving advice and
yes.
Like, being tactful about it.
Yeah.
Do you have any like tips or something to like how you go about it? Especially if the person that you're giving advice to doesn't really want that advice.
Well, I think if somebody doesn't want the advice, that's a clear message that even though you could, I mean, I'm always guided by our lamas. I think they could tell us so much if we're ready to hear. The Buddha, there were a number of different questions on which the Buddha remained silent because the Buddha deemed that, you know, people weren't ready to hear that. And we don't know because he remained silent on those topics. Okay? So that was at the time. So it's, you know, and I can say, well, I don't have the clairvoyance of a Buddha, but maybe you know your friends or whoever it is a little bit to know, maybe I'll just back off here, give the space, give the time, and maybe at some other time they might be ready to hear some advice. And, you know, you could always check in with them. Would you like me to give you my perspective? Or not, you know. So while someone's emotional, definitely not. Just let them talk. Or simply saying, how can I support you? And it might be support me by give me a hug. It might be support me by give me some time. It might be, you know, have a coffee. Could, you know, so you're letting them, like, I care for you and I want to support you. How can I do that? Because what we think might be useful is maybe not what they think's useful, isn't it? You know. At that time, maybe some other time, could be different, because you know it's easy for us to have a, you know, a bit of a bird's eye perspective on someone else's, what's going on for someone else. When we're in the midst of it, we don't have that bird's eye perspective. They've got it, and they could equally say, "Boy, could I have some advice for you?" Because it is a thing of really not taking. You know, not drawing the situation back to ourselves, because it's like, I want to give you advice. Why? Because I don't want to see you upset. Well, people get upset, or, you know, people get confused, or, in fact, the Buddha said, we're all confused, so, you know, join the club. But, you know, so a lot of it is about just being patient, and just the power of just being there is a lot. I mean, having said that, there was a friend of mine who went on for a year about, you know, re-going over the same situation again and again. And I thought, this is not healthy for her. And I did, you know, I wasn't advising her what to do except to say, please don't talk to me about that again. And I think that really helped her. It was, but I did that after a year, not after a week. And maybe she was ready to move on because it sort of seemed to help her move on from that situation. It was like, you know, you can get into something that you're obsessing about and you're just like reliving the whole situation again and again and again. It's not healthy. So at that point, it was a little bit skillful. But you trial and error. A lot of it is, isn't it? And you think, back off, won't try that one again. With that person, but guess what? The next friend's different. So not everyone's the same. Yes.
Actually, I just curious that if Buddhism, learning Buddhism can help people to overcome depression and anxiety.
Yes.
It's like sometimes people just can't let it go and they're overthinking too
much. Yeah. So, yes, Buddhism is all about letting go of grabbing hold of anything.
Yeah,
so, that yes. Well, so I know when I very first started with meditation, I was ecstatic because I thought this is the cheapest form of, you know, anxiety, management that there is. It's totally free, you know, doesn't cost a cent. Because with meditation, particularly like at the beginning when we're meditating on the breath, it has a naturally calming effect. You're not telling the mind to calm down. You know, there is a guy who put out a little book of calm, and it was exactly that, saying calm, calm, calm. But you don't have to do that. Simply by focusing on the breath, it's like your internal systems are rebalancing themselves, and it has a soothing, calming effect. And so simply by doing that, nothing else, that helps with reducing the anxiety, because it's the opposite. Calming is the opposite to being anxious. So that really helps a lot with that. And for something like depression, if you meditate, like, you know, visualize bright light, something like that, that really helps. Something that uplifts the mind, or joy, you know, as at the beginning where I said, you know, take delight or rejoice in everything that you are doing, and so forth. So that counteracts the depression, which, you know, it's like, I can't even get out of bed, I'm no good, I'm worthless, blah, blah, blah. So it's a training the mind in a different state that is positive and more, therefore more powerful. It's not a draining energy, it brings you empowering energy.
Oh, what if, well, I can't even, like, visualize? When I close my eyes, I still like thinking some negative thoughts.
But that's, you're deliberately cutting across that. Deliberately. So, are you able to focus on your breath?
Sometimes,
yeah. So, if it's harder with your eyes closed, keep your eyes open and focus that way. Because often when we close our eyes, because of the association with sleep or something, it immediately feels dark. So in that way, leave your eyes open, even a bit open enough to get light in, so you don't feel like you're being distracted by things around you, and still focus on your breath and feeling it as soothing. A really good way to do that is lying down, meditating lying down. And one of our teachers said it's going into the infirmary, like, you know, really feeling nurtured, and feel that it's just a soothing energy in your body, calming, calming, calming. So give it a try. What else? Thank you for your generosity of attention and questions and your dedication to the Dharma, which is amazing, amazing, amazing. And we can think about all the virtue, even the thoughts of generosity, as the Buddha said. That is the generosity. So, wow, how easy is that? So may that continue to grow and grow in our minds to benefit ourselves, to benefit others or those we encounter. May all beings live in peace. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings live in comfort and ease. May all beings experience every joy, everything their hearts desire. May I be responsible for this by myself alone. Okay. Thank you very much.